Please join me in prayer. Amen. You know, something about this season brings out the crankiness in preachers. I don't know if you've noticed this, but, you know, we've always got to say, well, yes, this, but not like that. Like, for example, a lot of preachers have a problem with the secularism of the way we, our society celebrates the season. No, we don't want to do Rudolph. We don't want to do Frosty. Not even that Ebenezer Scrooge. Good values. But the story we need is the story of Jesus. Jesus is the reason for the season. And you'll hear lots of sermons about that. Or sermons about against the commercialism of the day, the way we reduce our relationships to dollar figures and the right packaging. And lots of preachers talk about that a lot. I'm sure I will mention it again before we get to the end, but it's not my hobby horse. Or related to it, the luxuriousness of the season, the indulgence, the food while people are out there cold and hungry and starving. It's an important message to hear, but that's not the hobby horse I ride either. Or to remember those who are most brokenhearted, the time of year when the world is telling you have to be the most happy. And so a week from Wednesday here even, we're going to have a service, a longest night vigil, where we have an opportunity to acknowledge the way in which the happiest time of the year sometimes makes us feel the most sad. And if we can't acknowledge our grief and our loss, then we won't be able to celebrate truly either. So lots of different angles, lots of different perspectives, and they're all good things to be concerned about. My hobby horse goes like this. Christmas is not the founder's day of the Christian religion. You think about the sort of the customs we have around the birthday of Jesus. And that's of course the story. And some churches, this one included, sing happy birthday to Jesus on Christmas. I think that's a great tradition. It's a way to bring the children into the celebration, way to remind us about the festiveness and the celebration of the season. But I think we have to be careful, because Christmas is not just the celebration of the birth of Jesus for the followers of Jesus. It's not like Washington's birthday, the commemoration of a great man. It's not even like the way Buddha's birthday is in Buddhism, or the birthday of Muhammad is in Islam. It's not just the grateful celebration of a founder. Christmas, for the followers of Jesus, the spirituality, the theology of Christmas entails an understanding of a metaphysical event, that the whole world is transformed, that the what they would call in philosophy the ontological fabric of being, the nature of reality, is changed when God becomes flesh with the incarnation. And even for those of us who follow a more contemporary theological paths, Christmas is still not just the birth of Jesus. It can't be. It's also the birth of possibility. It's the birth of promise. It's the birth of the gift and demand of God with us, of that love in our lives, in our world, and in our hearts. Christmas, yes, centers around the story of the birth of Jesus. But it's not just our origin story. It's not just about where we came from. It's our goal story. It's a story about where we're headed, about where we're called to travel. Christmas isn't just about Jesus. Christmas is about us and our world and ourselves. I think that's why in this lectionary that we follow, every year Advent is filled with grand and apocalyptic visions of the future, of what it's going to be like, of the promised time, of God's kingdom, of this peaceable reign that I keep talking about. We see it in Isaiah week after week during Advent. in the passage you just heard, God promises, I'm going to create new heavens and a new earth. I'm going to make everything new. And the former things won't come to mind, won't bother us anymore in the same way, because we'll be glad and we'll be able to rejoice in the new creation, the new Jerusalem of joy and the delight of the people, pointing to the future, what God will do. There's a wisdom in our tradition that says something about the birth of Jesus points us to that new future. God will rejoice in the heavenly city. God will rejoice with God's people. And no more will we be weeping or distressed. No more will there be babies who are born only to live a few days. Or people who don't live out a whole lifetime. If you're 100 years old when you die, it says, you'll be considered a youth. In God's kingdom, what this means is all will thrive. All will do well. All will have bounty. Not a time of ease or inactivity. We'll keep planting, we'll keep producing, we'll keep working the work of our hands, and our fields will yield fruit. Our vineyards will yield crops. It's not that we have nothing to do, it's just that it works what we do, that what we do brings about its intent, brings about plenty. And so it's a time of that kind of active peace you heard me telling the kids about. Not just an absence of strife, but of thriving, of people doing well and doing well together. Even enemies like wolves and lambs, even if we hate each other the way wolves and lambs hate each other, we'll be able to sit together. And even the most ravenous of us will eat straw. Lions eat straw like the ox. And the serpents, the most poisonous, will eat dust and not victims. Because the promise says we will not hurt or destroy on all of God's holy mountain. We cannot understand the meaning of the birth of Jesus, of the coming of Jesus, of the incarnation of God among us, if we do not understand the promise of this way it will be. Israelites, the ones to whom Isaiah was preaching, they believed in a God of history. They believed in a God who would intervene and who would intervene on the side of the people. A heavenly parent who takes sides. You heard again the story, not between me or my sister, but for both of us. A heavenly parent who takes the sides of everyone. And this intervention becomes a time of blessing for us all, a way of life, of community, a way of peace. So God's peaceable reign comes to us as a promise from the Old Testament, and then when Jesus is born, it's promised to us again. It's a restatement of those promises for those of us who follow Jesus, but not just a restatement. It's the first fruits of those promises. The process of the unfolding of this reign is already underway. That's what happens in the birth of Jesus, that we see that the unfolding is already underway and we get to participate. That's our invitation. So today we take a special time to think about the peace of this peaceable kingdom. Yes, the absence of strife. Yes, the absence of violence. Yes, the absence of domination. But as I tried to say, it's also an active peace. It's a peace of support, of thriving, of community. And I wanted to lift up just three parts of that that we don't always talk about. One is peace. A peace time is a time of harmony. Of time of harmony and of balance. versus the chaos that we too often experience. War is nothing if not chaos. And you remember, you've heard, even during this recent election season, there's this romantic idea, this romantic poetry of an anarchy. We just need to clear it all away. We just need to burn everything down. We just need to clear the decks and start over. But that's only an invitation to chaos. It's a fantasy. I get that. But to have nothing in place gives us a world that's just unpredictable, that's just lawless. Chaos is, despite its poetry, to some of us, it's not a good thing. It's painful, it's unpredictable. No one can do anything. You think about children raised in households of chaos. These are children who come to the world with post-traumatic stress built in from the very youngest age, because there's nothing to be depended on. So the first thing peace requires is a kind of predictability that becomes a harmony, things in proportion to each other, things that are interrelated to each other, that we can depend on each other. The absence of chaos comes when I know I can depend on you, and when you know you can depend on me, that we're dependent and that we're dependable. So harmony, the absence of chaos, that's the first thing I think peace means. A second is freedom. Along with this dream of chaos, we've heard so much about a dream of conformalism, objectifying definitions, predeterminations of who you have to be. Well, you're the mom, so that means you have to do it like this. Or you're a consumer, so that means you're going to behave that way. Or you're going to be, when you go home to Christmas, maybe you'll be the identified patient again this year, so that everyone can circle their anxieties around you, so that they don't have to feel their own. We all get stuck in these roles in life, in the economy, in the political life, in our social circles, in our families. We think about the predetermined definitions of who people are. Whole classes of people, too. Well, you know, you're a millennial. I can't tell you how many books I get every week from the church growth industry telling me, well, you know, the millennials, this is what they're like. Well, you know what? They don't have to be like that. Or we've heard this rhetoric for years. African Americans, here's what you're like. Here's what your communities are like. Here's what what niches you're gonna get stuck into in our society. Or a woman, or a man. We know what that means when you say you're one of those things. No. Peace requires freedom. Predetermination, constraint, these are not peace. No matter how compliant they render their victim, compliance is not peace. So, yearn for balance and interdependence. Yearn for freedom. And finally, peace requires acknowledgement versus anonymity. It is so easy to imagine a strife-free world like the backseat of the car. What I didn't tell the kids is my folks used to give us Dramamine to make us go to sleep. It's easy to imagine that strife-free world where we all pass each other anonymously on the streets and we don't trouble each other and no one troubles anyone. That's not peace. That's just social-wide detente. If we're going to depend on each other, and if we're going to liberate each other, we have to know each other. We have to acknowledge each other. We have to attempt, I talked about this a few weeks ago, we have to attempt the hardest imaginative act there is. I have to try to imagine what it must be like to be you. And you're invited to try to imagine what it must be like to be someone else, to be me, in our lives together. So I can recognize you, so I can acknowledge you, so I can see that we are in this together, so we can come together to work out how we can be freer, how we can be more harmonious. We've become so adept at not seeing each other and not knowing each other, and the peaceable reign, this peaceable kingdom, requires that we see each other. So for all those reasons, Christmas is not the founder's day of Christianity. It is about Jesus in a way, but more importantly, it is about us. And it is about the transformation of our world from chaos into harmony, from conformity into freedom, from anonymity into communion. In short, it is about the transformation of our world into a peaceable realm. And it's about the transformation of our hearts in the same way. Your inner balance, your inner freedom, your own acknowledgement of your very own selfhood. Christmas is about the kingdom of peace. Born in a manger, you can see him. The peacefulness, the promise of peace in that baby. But just not just then, but now too. Born in a manger again this year that we're going to set up in the middle of this city so everyone can see that baby as a promise of peace to the whole world. And born in a manger we set up in our own hearts, again to be our own promise of peace. And with Christ is born comes the promise of peace. Amen.